And we're now talking about programming, to a certain extent. Is that what I'm talking about there? No, position, sorry. Position of the campsite is very, very important. And there's obviously all kinds of areas there, lake and mountain. They need to be thought about seriously. A lake's good. You need to think. Now, is this lake safe or is it not safe? That's a very serious question. I've been to Tookley now three times. I've been to Tookley twice while I've been here for two weekends. I went here last time I was here, some 5 years ago, whatever. And having been there, as I say now, for three weekends, I've never yet seen the lake. I've been locked up counselling and working and so on. I was on my way to see the lake last weekend and I was just going across the green. And I thought, oh, Malcolm, I wonder if I could talk to you for a while. And so I didn't see the lake. But you need to think about this. We've got a camp in New Zealand, two camps, on the edge of Lake Karapiro, which is a very deep lake. And the lake really is, it works anti. Because the lake is so dangerous and the banks are so steep and they don't feel they can sort of fence them off adequately that it really works against them. And lots of families will not go there in their instance because it's, see, Tookley, you've got to sort of walk a distance to get there. And I, as I say, I haven't seen the lake, but I presume it's got the beaches instead of shallow. This you've got, it's just, you know, the bank comes straight down like that, and there it is. And you walk over the bank, and you're sort of 40 feet deep, which is a problem. And that really works against them. Folks, it wouldn't be good for powerboats, but who can afford to run a powerboat when your petrol in New Zealand is close to, well, it's 99 cents a gallon, 99 cents a litre, I'm sorry. That's a lot of money, you know, when you run a boat. So you can do canoeing, but how many people in a family camp want to go canoeing? So you need to think, is this, it's a nice spot, but is this going, or are we going to set ourselves up? I know a friend, he's got a in Lake Wakamaru. His camp is an island in the middle of a lake, and he features that, and boating and fly fishing and trout fishing, and he's able to give licenses, is really quite magnificent. So when you look at a site, you've got to ask yourself, now, the site is good, but if I have the site, I've got to make sure that I'm going to build my camp to suit the site. A mountain, I was taken down to the South Island a while ago, some people were going to buy an old ski lodge. Well, it wasn't an old one, it was magnificent. And they'd done their homework on it, but it was a bit restrictive, and they wouldn't be able to use it possibly through the summer months, and therefore it was no good. Is that to stop? A river, the sea, a forest. One there that may interest you, or the last two may need a little bit of explanation. A geological area. We're fortunate in Metameta because during the time of the flood, Noah's flood that is, the whole river changed. And there are these, you can see where the ancient river used to be, and there's the limestone rocks. And for particularly high schools, that would be kids in our age, you know, 15, 16, 17, 18, they do geological studies down this valley, and it's just full of interest. So we advertise that in our brochures because it's good. We've also got places like museums and so on that are of great value. We're a rural area. We're not close to a lake. Our rivers are not really worth counting where we are. A Lake Karapiro, I've mentioned, is about 30 miles away, so you're not going to go there before morning tea. So we don't use it, obviously. But we've got some magnificent dairy farms. We've got some fantastic stud farms and farms like, you know, Bone Crusher, Horse Stud and Battle Wagon and Battle Heights. Brilliant studs, millions of dollars. Some of these studs, they're so wealthy that there is carpet in the foyer of the stables, and the carpet goes in the foyer and down the side. The only place that hasn't got carpet is in the actual box where the horse sleeps and lives. I mean, the wealth is just unbelievable. You go and touch a horse, and you run your hand across $2 million worth of horse flesh, you know. But they're lovely, and so we advertise them. There's a lot of dairy factories that do butter and powder and various other ones. So you scratch around and say, now, why should a group come to us? Why should an education group come to us? Now, we've got playing fields, we've got stream, we can do spot studies, we can do geological studies, we can do bush studies, we can now do animal studies, we've got different breeds of sheep and different types of birds, and they can do all those studies, but what's in the district? And we found a tremendous amount of things with a short distance, folk can go and do something of real value. So it's a good idea in your camp to sketch around, you know, what have we got? And sometimes you find all sorts of things, and you may have a pottery factory that kids would like to go and see that. So when you're thinking about your site, think about it very, very carefully. Consider the climate. Can it be all round? I'm Well, we're sorry it wasn't the Lord's will. I was talking about it today, as a matter of fact, when I was putting these notes together, finally doing the acetate. A friend came to me once and offered me, he was a very wealthy man and a brilliant engineer, and said, "Malcolm, I've been thinking, how about my wife and I, and me and my wife, what if the four of us," I had kids by then, but he hadn't, "said, why don't we go to England and buy a castle and start a camp? There are very few, if any, real full-time camps in England, because they say, and I know lots of full-time workers have been there, I've been there two or three times, and they say, well, you can't have camping here because the weather's against it. But in Queenstown, where we are, in the South Island, there's lots of snow, and that's the marvellous time of the year. And in England, I used to live there as a kid, snow would be fantastic. But they just say, you can't do it. Because when they think of camping, it's tents. And this guy had the idea of a castle, and it never came off. But he did a fair amount of research, and we would have got one for just under $500,000. And a bit run down, but we would have done it up. But that's their problem in Britain. They say, you can't do it. So think of the climate. Heat, cold, adverse weather conditions. The distance from a populated area. We have a camp that is a lovely camp on the edge of a lake in New Zealand that is dying because it's too far away from any major city. And the greatest cost is the transport cost. In fact, to us, we're 100 miles from Auckland exactly. From the Auckland Harbour Bridge to the gates of our camp is exactly 100 miles, right to the last yard. But it costs them to bring, say, three busloads. That it costs them more for their buses than it does for the children's accommodation with us. So you have to think very carefully. You know, now it's all very well building a camp out in the Wops, but you know, is this going to be prohibitive for people to get their transport out? Is it too far away? See, I think Tukli is just ideal. It's not too far, but I wouldn't want to go much further. You know, but it's good, and you know, battling with the traffic is a bit of a problem. So think about that. Accessibility. See, this guy that has his camp in a lake, one of the great problems is getting people there. Because he's got a boat that you put people on, but of course it fills with people and, you know, cases and suitcases. And it's a real fair getting, you know, 70 or 80 people across the lake to his thing. It's quite a big undertaking. So, you know, is our camp easily accessible? Can people get to it? Places of interest around, sure, we've talked about that. Christian support. Whatever you do in regard to camp work, never be a loner. There are people who do things, they get something going, like establish a camp. And having established the camp, they then go and ask the churches around to support it. Now, I know a fellow who started a camp in New Zealand, didn't say boo to any of the assemblies, that's brethren assemblies, round about, didn't say a word. Then when he wanted some money, he went to them and they said, oh, buzz off, buddy. First of all, you didn't ask us in the first place. Secondly, you've built your camp in totally the wrong place. We are not interested. You can never be a loner in God's work. Never want to do your own thing. It's a team ministry. It's a body ministry. It's a togetherness. And that's important. So, you know, don't just go tearing off doing your own thing. Your closeness to neighbours, for instance, noise. We're fortunate. We can use our mics, our outdoor mics, and call people in. Some camps can't because of the neighbours. We're very careful with our mics, and we use them with great care. We don't use them before 7:30 in the morning or after 9:30 at night, and we stop anybody being an idiot. But we're surrounded by farms, and I don't suppose in the next 100 years they'll be built out. But noise carries a long way, and farmers get up at 4:30 in the morning in the milking season, and they could be annoyed being woken up at 11 o'clock at night by some clot on a microphone. So you think about the people around you. A lovely camp that's a super camp site in Auckland called Eastern Beach, they're totally surrounded by houses and they can't use anything outside, even a buzzer, a bell or anything like that. It's a problem. And they have difficulties to call people in, and their rates are very, very high. But they survive very well. It's a very good camp. Alright, the future town planning. Always, it's a good idea, even at Tukli, you know, to once every so often drift into the town planning office and just find out what they plan to do to make sure they don't want to put a highway straight to the middle of your camp. A friend of mine was going to buy some land in the hope of establishing a small camp, and I said, well, that's, you know, I don't think it's a good idea, but, you know, it is an idea, and I suppose if you want to, well, I can't stop you. But I said, I really think you should go to the town planning first, because the land was so cheap. And this was just outside the town of a house called Hamilton, and there's a proposal for a great big highway to go through, right through the middle of the land, so it was cheap. It's a good idea just to know what the county council are doing, or the borough council, or whatever, city council. Just have some idea what they plan to do in the future, so that you don't, they suddenly don't start coming along and something else. Did I tell you about our camp being closed down for our hot pool? Did I talk about that? Did I mention that? That gave us a shock. The reason we got off, pardon? Yes, we have a hot pool, and obviously it's a health problem, because amoebas, you know, get in there and they think, wow, we, and they breed like mad. And we have an amoeba that causes meningitis, which is a killer disease where we're concerned. So we have to make sure our pool is absolutely 100% safe. I wouldn't even use it if I thought it wasn't safe. So every week it is scrubbed and chlorinated and it's all looked after and people shower before the end. But I'm always worried about it. You know, it's an area of danger. And we, for the last 5 years, have been going to the health department regularly saying, look, you know, is anything we should be doing with this pool? No, Malcolm, your pool's fine, it's clean, you look after it, water's 1,000 feet down, can't be polluted that deep, comes up a pipe, goes in, no way of pollution, people shower, it empties every 4 hours, it's completely refilled, it's flowing through all the time, concrete bottom, concrete lip water, the water that washes off can't wash back in again, and, you know, fine. And regularly we say, when the health department says, oh, look, what about the pool? Is the pool okay? And in a lot of hot pools in New Zealand, you mustn't put your head underwater because you get the amoeba up your nose, you see, and that kills you. And I said, what about the notices? No. Look, you don't apply. It doesn't apply to you. So I said, oh, bust it. So I put a notice up, you see, that it's not a good idea because you're nervous. You know, it's a lovely hot pool and it's super. And I mean, we all swim in it and dive. You can't stop kids diving and swimming. But they came along the other day, turned up and said, oh, we're very, very sorry to tell you, but we're closing your camp down this afternoon at 3:00. And that was it. And I said, why? And they said, well, because your pool does come up to standards, but we have a new health inspector, and until he's inspected all the hot pools in the area, he's closing them all. Maybe a month before he gets round to see that yours is okay and open it. Now, that was a ridiculous legislation that would absolutely have ruined us financially. And I was able to say, hold it. Always keep a copy of your letters, you know. See those? Well, that's when I've written to you people, and we've been for the last 5 years saying, what do we have to do? If you do this, we'll get a court injunction to keep ourselves open. We will also make sure that the newspaper knows about it. Now, where are we? Then I said to the guy, I will say it again to you, sir. You tell us what we've got to do for our hot pool. And this is exactly what I said. I will have an army of men here tomorrow, and we will spend tomorrow up to $10,000 without even a committee meeting to make that pool come up to the standards that you insist on. Now, you tell us what to do, and we'll do it. And I would have done it. And to get Christians to come to an emergency is peanuts. They'd be there with bells hanging out, tractors, shovels, they'd have been there. And they're good guys. You get a farmer, he knows what he's all about. And I know the committee would have said, Malcolm, spend the $10,000, let's do it. I didn't have to have a committee meeting on an issue like that. And he said, oh, well, I said, now that's the deal. You tell us what to do, and I will spend $10,000 tomorrow so that the pool, this was on Wednesday, so that the weekend we will still be open. He said, oh, well, we'll have to go away and think. So I said, well, then you cannot close the damn story. Well, they haven't been back since. You see, this health inspector, brand new guy, knew that hot pools have a danger element. And so I said, right, they're all closed, you see. But because we'd been nibbling away for 5 years at the Te Rau County Council, they just couldn't walk in and say, the end. So it's important that you keep making overtures to your county council. If ever you're changing your kitchen, never change the kitchen. Say to the health inspector, look, we're changing our kitchen. We'd just like your advice and your help. For instance, in our land, you're not allowed to have cupboards over 6 feet high because the policy is nobody will clean over 6 feet high. Your cupboard must either then go to the ceiling or it must have a sloping ceiling so you can't put stuff on the top of the cupboard that will gather dust. You cannot have a brace leg going down off a bench to the side of the wall, so like down like that. It must be straight because on an angle it'll gather dust. Now, if you go to them first, they are very, very nice. We found them very, very nice. We've never had a problem except this new guy, and we seem to have recovered from that. But if you do it, and you haven't asked their advice, they seem to get a little bit uptight, certainly in our country, and they'll do their level best to find fault with you. So make sure that you don't treat the borough council or county council or town councils as enemies. Treat them as friends and use their resource. and let them do the research. You know, if they say, you've got to have a dishwasher, say, well, we'd love to have a dishwasher. We would like you to tell us the type we need to have, the type we need to buy. They can do all the phoning. They can do all the research. They can bring all the pamphlets. They can provide all. You just look it over and do it. Or else you can spend a whole week tearing around warehouses and doing your own thing. Use them. Then when you put it in, if they come and condemn it, say, well, it was your idea. So don't treat them as enemies. We have had very, very lovely relationships with them over very, very many years. All right, down there we're now talking about the program and that we're thinking of in what you're doing. And it's a group living in a stable Christian environment. And so the program will be governed very much by the environment and the type of the campsite. Use the natural environment. This gives the camp its, oh, I should have said character, I think, better than uniqueness, I guess, but both words are okay. Design the buildings to blend in with the surroundings. So if it's a mountain camp, design your buildings to suit. Make sure your buildings fit the surrounds. Don't chop all the trees down and then start building. Find out how you can adapt your camp to the natural facilities around the place. Hills, valleys, rivers, streams, all those things, trees, are tremendously important. And develop the campsite to accommodate the main concept. What are we trying to do? All right, if specializing, for example, on horses, a ranch type of camp, or canoeing or tramping, make sure, that's, we've now come down a little bit, we've missed that little bit, I'll get back to that, make sure that you've got a sufficient market for it. When I was in Australia a while ago, I was taken, and it was miles away from here in some other state, and you would never know where it is, but I was taken to a guy that was starting a camp for horses, and it was, that's all there was. If you didn't like riding horses, it was no use going. And I said, well, that interests me, because if a youth group, so say I am at Parramatta all the time, or Oakley, or wherever, if your youth group were going, there's a lot of people don't want to ride horses in the average youth group of 70 people, wouldn't give you a thank you to get a horse. We've got horses, we've got 15 horses and a couple of donkeys, and that's enough. In fact, you can often have just 6 horses out for 100 people. And, you know, there's only 21 a ride. The rest will sit on the fence watching, but they don't want to ride. You know, I've never got my wife on a horse yet. And there are so many people who don't want to ride horses. So if you make a camp that is just a horse ranch camp, you may have restricted the use of it because you're making it so specialised, it's not a general purpose camp, and only those people that want to do that can come. It may be a tramping camp. Now, they're very successful in our country, but you've got to have the right places to go, and it's got to be something of sort of national interest. You're just going to go wandering through a bit of bush. All right, so think carefully that if you specialise in something, you're not pushing yourself out of the market. And the average camp, I think, we need to make sure that we're catering basically for the average middle-of-the-road person. When I prepare a sermon, I think of 4 average people that I know, and I think of them. When I prepare any message, I still do it, when I prepare a message, will they understand that word? If they wouldn't understand the word goes out. Will they understand that phrase? Wouldn't understand it, I've got to rephrase it. I'm talking about a doctrine, would they understand that? No, they wouldn't. And I always prepare my sermons with very, very average people in mind. Remember this, and we're on to homiletics now. It's not the words you use that matter, it's the ideas you put across. Never use language that people have got to battle with your language. If they're struggling to understand your words, they will never get around to understanding what you're saying. So use simple words they don't have to struggle with, but put across good concepts. Good, it would always be simple, be easy to listen to. But if people have got to struggle with your words, they'll say, wasn't that beautiful? But afterwards, they won't remember much. I forget the 3 preachers, but somebody went to London, and I think it was A.T. Pearson, Spurgeon, and somebody else, and it went like this. The first is, wasn't he a tremendous orator? Terrific. Then they went to hear A.T. Pearson, great preacher. Wasn't he a tremendous poet? Terrific. And then they went to hear Spurgeon in the evening. First one was, what an orator. Second, what a poet. Third, what a saviour. The last guy communicated. You don't want people to say, what an orator. You blew it. When they walk away from you, what a saviour. What a God. What a Bible. People think it's smart to use complicated words. Think it's clever. Don't. Never get caught in that dumb trap. And when you're planning your camp, usually make sure your camp is going to cater for the greatest majority of people, unless there is a specialised group you're after, like periodic detention people, people in prison, that kind of thing. You're working a camp just for those. Well, all right, that will be a very specialist camp, but you don't be sure you're going to get the clientele. So we've talked briefly about that. Be sure of the market. Plan to cater for the total person, physically and emotionally. It's rather interesting at camp. I don't know what you do at your camps. We, in our camps we run, we don't allow radios or transistors, cigarettes or matches, and that sort of thing. But of course, schools come, and we tell school, well, we're not really happy about transistors, you see. And so, oh, why? I said, well, it's a lovely spot, and there's, you know, it's in the country, and there's trees and streams and birds, and, you know, don't you want your children to have a totally new experience? You see? Oh, good idea, Malcolm. Yeah, right, no transistor, see. So, no trend now for a kid of 15 to live without his transistor is a problem. I mean, some people have radio clocks that it wakes them up with music and the news. They wake up listening to the radio. They get dressed listening to the radio. I've even been in the house I was in the other day. You go to the toilet and there's a radio part of the toilet roll. And as you sit down, you turn on the thing and you've got the radio in there, in the loo, for goodness sake. And then they walk out and they're having breakfast and they turn on the radio. They get in the car and as they turn on the key, the radio comes on. Work all day, the radio is blaring. When they get into the car at night, the radio is going. When they get home, they sit down in front of television. When they go to bed at night, there's the radio and they go to bed. And they wonder why the Spirit of God never talks to them. The Spirit of God will never talk to a believer if his mind is full of this world's junk. We want the Spirit of God teaching me, so we don't have transistors. But the other day I was coming back, or it was a few other days ago actually. The other day to me can be 10 years back if you like, okay? And this was just a while ago, and the lady was coming, she was a mother in one of the camps. And I said, hello, how are you? She said, oh, fine. And I said, you enjoying camp? I can't stand the place. Now, if you don't like Turtle Springs, you've got an enemy. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, why is that? She said, I can't stand the silence. I thought, lovely. You see, why do people live with the radio noise? Because they can't live with themselves. That's why. They can't live with their own thoughts. They've got to have noise so they don't have to face the real self. She'd been there now for 3 days. There was nowhere to hide. There was no barrage of noise putting songs and ideas in her mind. She was living with herself and she didn't like what she found. This is why in an adventure-bound camp that you may run, you've got to be very careful if you do this. You put a kit, okay, Brad, there's your gear. You've got a little bit of food. You've got a box of matches. You've got a little bit of this. You've got a torch. There's your mat. That's where you're going. And we don't want to see you back until 48 hours. You're in the bush on your own. Many people never survive. Not the food. They cannot bear the loneliness. But for those who do, it's an amazing experience where they rediscover themselves. The first time they've ever sat down. So we don't like to have noise around the place. It's something you need to think about emotionally. Educationally and spiritually are all things that you've got to consider. We're going to have to move along a little bit. Established camps, as some of us are. We talked a little bit about this at the beginning, so I won't say much more, but review the original visions and goals. And remember, every organisation starts off with a man or a woman with a vision. It then deteriorates into a movement. Ever heard about the Brethren movement? And then from a movement, it becomes a machine clanking along, just going through the motions. Nobody quite knows why, but we just keep doing it. And then after a while, it becomes a monument. The only thing used for monuments are for pigeons. And I find a lot of churches that are monuments. They're not doing anything. They're doing everything right, but they're not doing anything. And you've got to make sure that your camp never loses its original vision. Some people have glorious goals, and the goals become, we talked about goals the other week, the goals become more important than what they're actually doing. So keep looking at your camp. Are we reaching our original vision or our original philosophy? And every year, well, more than every year, when I give reports, we have a camp, we have a management meeting once every 6 weeks, we have a trust board meeting probably 3 or 4 times a year, and so on. And I'm, of course, involved in the management meeting. My wife and I are there. Always involve your wives, you people. If you have a committee meeting at your camp, your wife has got to be there. Now, that's the law. Occasionally, believe it or not, I get invited to go and maybe be a pastor of a church. people are very gracious or very hard up. And a while ago, a gang asked me if I'd like to become a pastor of a very large church, very gracious. I went originally and met with them because I didn't believe I should go, but I felt, well, at least let's give God a chance to say yes or no. I went and met them, and I liked what I saw, and I felt, well, the time's got to come when you leave the Springs. And so I said, well, I'm prepared to meet the elders, but I would like my wife to come. And my wife was there. Some 2 years ago, 5 full-time workers in New Zealand went to the wall. They were young full-time workers. They all went to the wall. They got out of full-time work. They all crashed. Nervous breakdowns, all sorts of things. I got involved in the 5 of them. There were more than that. But in these 5 I got involved in when it was too late. And the thing that amazed me was, not once in all the trauma and the tragedy and the heartache and the distress and the tension had the wife ever been involved with the elders in the discussion. That is so dumb. See, we men are very macho when we get home to our wives and we tell our wives what we said at the committee meeting. We didn't say that at all. But we said, well, I told them. I told them straight. No, we didn't. We, like a little mouse, squeaked and said, well, if you put it back home to our wife, we've got to be a hero. And our wife can't understand why they didn't take any notice. So she gets all upset. You always have your wife. If you are the director of a camp and you've got a trust board, your wife has got to be allowed to be involved. You're a marriage, you're one flesh, you're a unity. And she's got to be there. Now, I should have said management board. My wife doesn't worry about the trust board. That doesn't worry. They just make the policy and just check that everything's going right. The management board is where the decisions are made with us. And that's why it's tremendously important your wife is involved. She knows what's happening. She knows what's going on. And sometimes wives will say things to trust boards that we men won't say because we're too proud. You're exhausted, you're tired, and your wife will say, look, you guys, you just don't understand, etc., etc. You know, the hours that you work and so on. They have no idea. So just remember that. Renew your goals and your visions. All right, property ownership, trust and management is something that you need to get sorted out very, very carefully so that you suddenly don't find that you've inherited a committee that has no idea of what's going on. What are you? Are you a non-profitable trust? That's what we are. We're a non-profitable trust. Fine. We have a trust board that really is responsible for if we were to crash financially, they would have to come up with the goods. They meet 2 or 3 times a year and they look at the policy, they look at the budget and the accounts, and so on and so forth, but they just make sure that I was there, I don't stay for the whole meeting, I present a written report, and remember when you present a report, don't just give your written report to the chairman and the secretary, write a report and give it to every individual in your trust board so they can all read it, all right? If you're in ever trouble, and I do not believe, how can I phrase it? There are people who condemn committees. I am all for committees. The person that condemns a committee is usually such an irascible sort of a person, he can't even get on with himself when he looks in the mirror to shave. We have to learn to get on. And Tokra Springs, which is a lovely camp, is a camp like it is because we have a fantastic committee. It would never have been like that without those marvellous men. Now, they're a fantastic, but you've got to look after your committee. You've got to involve your committee. You've got to, when I'm away, you've got to write to your committee. Let them know what I'm doing here. When I go back, I will either get Mr. Graham Hayden, who's organized my trip over here, or Mr. Trevor Young, who I've been staying with, to write to my committee, and they will tell them exactly what I've done. While Malcolm was here, this is what he did. We were disappointed with what he did, or we were happy with what he did. We felt he was unwise with whatever. Every Christian person has got to be answerable to somebody. There is no such thing as God's man. The Bible condemns wandering stars, Book of Jude. So be careful of that. And our trust board is very, very good and marvellous. And our committee, for instance, our ceiling, we couldn't line our ceiling in our main dining room. It was a big hall and a big ceiling. $5,000 to line it with the stuff we wanted to line it with. We didn't want to just put boards up. One of our committee said, Malcolm, I know your ceiling wants doing. It really does. It looks bad like that. Tell you what, he said, I've got a stag sale coming up, and the first stag sold is yours. Now, the first stag, of course, is always the best. People buy the best and they work their way down. And so we got our ceiling lined. His thanks to our Lord. But you know, this that's a committee member. Whenever I'm stuck, I ring the committee up. You know, you guys, they need to know they're the committee. And I get them very involved. And they're fabulous people. And I don't think in the 16 years we've been there we've ever had a crossword. We've had a few eyeball-to-eyeball chats. But we've never had a crossword. We've never got angry. And I'd hate to think that happened. It doesn't have to happen. But I hear people, whenever I go to camping conferences, and I go to a lot of camping conferences, and that isn't a boast, but I go there to speak, every time at a camping conference for a weekend, somebody's moaning about their committee. Now, some committees don't know what a committee's about. I've got a little booklet on how to be a successful committee member. It's a little leaflet, actually. And one or two people, I've given that to a new committee member, and said, well, I'd like you to read this. The Christian Camping Journal is very, very good. CCI puts out some good stuff. And there are helpful things there. But you need to include your committee so your committee is involved. Never treat your committee as the enemy. Never have a them and us concept. It's us. And you need to educate your committee and involve your committee and get your committee out and take them round and let them know your burdens and your problems. But a lot of committees are problems because they don't think about the camp until they, or whatever. I mean, I take an organization like this, there may be a committee that runs Emmaus. Many of them may not be theological men, they may not understand what it is to be a lecturer or a teacher or what's necessary in a classroom, what needs to happen in a classroom. They wouldn't understand the value of this and the screen and the other things you need. They're just committee men that somehow got the job because they're an elder in the church. They don't think about the place until they walk into the committee room. And when they walk out of the committee door, that's when they stop thinking about it. So they come along with no original thoughts, no pre-thinking at all. And they're very frustrating. So you need to make sure that you write to these people, ring them up, talk to them, get to know them, so that when they come, they feel a part of the problem. See, some people want to be so much me, 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 I, my ways, they deliberately treat their committee like that. You usually end up with a committee the way you treat them. Now, there are some duds on committees, but after a while, the Lord sort of pushes them off to the side. But you need to educate your committee and look after them. Write to them, ring them up, phone them. I've had a couple of committee members, they'll never hear the tape, and they hadn't been to a management committee meeting for about 3 sessions. And they're very good people. So I wrote them a personal note and said, look, we really need you there, could you please come? And they came. I said, Malcolm, we didn't realise you wanted us there that much, we just didn't feel, you know, we counted. And they haven't missed since. And they're tremendous people. They're thinking business people and Christians. So look after that. The camp director and what his responsibility is and how he works and functions. And then you've got a camp manager, maybe, that manages the site, worries about the lawns, the buildings, the maintenance, all that, which is important. My wife and I, I'm the camp director. She is the assistant camp director, so that when I'm away, I was put in the minutes that she is responsible. She calls the shots, and I've got a letter here where she had to call the shots while I was away. Then you've got your camp staff that we'll talk about, and you've got, they need a, for all of these people, that's the director, the manager, and here, and also your committee, a clear job description. Now, whenever you write it, we're not talking about job descriptions tonight, you'll probably be dealing with that somewhere down the line. Job descriptions are important. Two things. You can never make the man fit the job. That's impossible. You've always got to make the job fit the man. So you look at the man, you find out what his skills are, what his case is like, what his wife is like, and you've got to rearrange the job for the man or find another man or woman. But it is hopeless to change the man. He is not going to find what we were talking about last week, job satisfaction. You're putting a square peg in a round hole, it's not going to work. A lot of people do that. You see churches do this. We want a pastor. So they get a preacher. A man that's a preacher. And they try to make a pastor out of a preacher. And what do? They put an office in the church. They give him an office and a secretary and a telephone and a typewriter. And they make him an administrator. He's not an administrator's elbow. He is a preacher. And so he's a dud. And they say, there you are, full-time workers don't work. He's a fantastic preacher, but he's not an administrator. He's not a guy behind a desk. He's not really a pastor. He's a preacher. You get a guy that's a good pastor, and you want him to come into the church, and you give him the majority of the preaching, and the church goes, and he's not a preacher. He's a pastor. One-to-one, he's good. You can't make the job fit the man. Sorry, you can't make the man fit the job. You've got to make sure that the job suits the man or the couple. And when they have children, you've got to rearrange the job and the responsibilities. So that's important. Accommodation, where they're going to live. Oh, the other thing about the job description, whenever you write a job description, the word etc. is very, very useful. Because you sometimes get an ungodly person. That was in my job description. So you've got to make sure that your job description is specific in the main areas, but broad in the areas, because in camp work, how can you write a job description that is watertight for a camp worker? I mean, I'm always finding bits of paper. Every time my wife watches, I wish you'd take the blooming papers out of your pockets. When I walk along, I see a piece of paper, pick it up, put it in my pocket because it's dirty. You pick it up. Now, you can't write that in a job description. What I did, nasty, I had a staff that I couldn't sort of get going a while ago. So we have a new staff almost every year with students, you see, or every 2 years, which is very busy. And, of course, it happened this year, and I shouldn't really be in Australia in March because my wife had to do all the sort of breaking of these students. And they were bad around the site. So I got a pair of pliers. And I put a pair of pliers on the side of the road that everybody walks down into the dining room in the main work. The pliers are just on the side by the grass. There's the grass here. And there was the road, and they were just on the road, they're on the tar seal, they were there, you see. So I put them there Monday, and the next Monday morning, I walked down and picked them up. In the staff meeting, I said, anybody seen me before? Everybody had seen them. Everybody, every single staff member, apart from, I guess, my wife, who works in the office and doesn't go to camp, must have walked by those pliers at least 3, 4, some of them 10 times a day for 7 days, and not one staff member picked them up. Nobody did. And I said, well, look, you guys, that's lousy. See, they're rusty, it's been raining. Now, you people have got to learn, if you see a job that needs doing, you do it. So you've got a general job description. But okay, so the bench is dirty. Don't tell the cook, wipe it. We have a law in our kitchen, and the cook's got his pots, and the law simply is, when you walk through the kitchen, there are pots to wash, stop, wash the pots, and keep going. And it takes you 2-3 minutes, and the cook is thrilled. And you keep his pots down. Everybody on our staff, I wash pots, wash lots of pots, but that's all I do when I go there to help. Because we've got a chef, I would never go into the kitchen and tell the chef what to do. I go and say, righto, Ross, we're not going to do civil milk, do you mind all those pots? And I just wash pots. My hands are as good as anybody else's. And it's also good morale, if it's good enough for me to wash pots, it's good enough for anybody else to wash pots. I don't think I should have to wash pots as a director, and it's not in my job description, but it's a morale thing. So you can't have a watertight job description and the word is etc. or everything relating to that field or whatever, but you've got to make sure it's broad enough. Talk about accommodation, what that involves for us. It's accommodation and power. They pay their own telephone. What the wages are going to be and allowances for certain things. We have a $200 a month petty cash allowance so that if you two guys were going to town, you're going to Hamilton, which is about 40 miles away, you were going to pick up some gear, I would give you probably $30 and you'd buy yourself lunch or whatever. And so you don't have to just go to McDonald's, you'd get somewhere nice and just sit down and have lunch. If you've got any money over, sometimes they hand it back. I say, I don't want to see it. When we have birthdays, it's embarrassing in your staff for everybody, buy everybody. This guy's got a birthday, we've all got to buy something. Some of us can't afford it. So the camp automatically has $25 a birthday for anybody, $20 I think is for a child that has a birthday. And the staff, if they want to, can add to it. And we just say to his wife, what does your husband want for his birthday? And we go and buy it, and I'll talk about that later. But that's our petty cash. And the committee said, Malcolm, it's your petty cash. I don't want to know what you spend it on. I can't trust you with the petty cash. You should not be the director. I don't have to keep an account of that. And we use it for all sorts of little bits and pieces. But I'll tell you this, if I gave you two jerks $30 to have lunch in Hamilton, you'd be grateful. And you'd give me that $30 back in work and loyalty 100 times over. Have you ever been in an atmosphere where there isn't a good atmosphere? Where everybody's looking at everybody else and sneaky and angry, and that little bit of fun has got a barb in it, everybody's trying to get at everybody else. You can't handle that. You just can't handle it. You've got to get out. Your nerves won't take it. And if I know that, I'd say, hey, there's a problem between you and her. And I know what's going on, but either fix it up or talk to me about it, but fix it. And you've got to have it fixed by tonight. Now it's 10 o'clock this morning, 5 o'clock tonight, you two jerks, I've got to have that sorted out. Got it? Or else you'll be in my office and we'll sort it out there. Can't have that atmosphere going on. When women have got a greater sense of spirituality than men, you see that in the Bible, you don't find men doing the wonderful things that women did. They've got a greater capacity for love and compassion. But when that capacity goes sour, they've got a greater capacity for being lousy than men. And when women fall out, I mean, you and I, John and I, we could have a terrible row or something right now. I don't know what. We'd have a real eyeball to eyeball. 10 minutes later, we'd be in the car going along and say, well, let's pick up a Big Mac as we go home. Buddies! Women can have a row and it can go for months. And the whole outfit, because they are far more sensitive, they've got a deeper sensitivity than we men have got. When we interview couples, we interview the wife a lot harder than we do the man. The woman gets far deeper going over than the guys do. You get a woman who's not going to be supportive, and you've got a real problem on your hands. So we talk about the job description, and we talk about allowances. Personal staff, we'll just zap down this. You've got your permanent staff, and that should be personnel, staff and leaders. A committed Christian known to be so, commended by their own church. All our staff, students, camp manager, farm manager, bits and pieces, everybody is commended by their home assembly. So if you two kids were going to come and work for 6 months at Totra Springs, I would want a letter of accommodation, not to full-time work, but to work at Totra Springs. If you were coming as a student for a year, I would want a letter of accommodation. If you, sir, are coming as the chef with your wife and your 15 kids, we would want a letter of commendation from your church, not commending you to full-time work, but commending you to serve the Lord at Totra Springs and the work related to it. Which means if we've got a follow-up in Auckland, then that involves that. So you're commended, so that if anybody starts getting stoppy, say, hang on, you might be getting paid for this job, but you're serving the Lord. You are a commended worker. You see, the reason is because when I went, I was a commended worker, and I thought it was a good thing. If you want to fire anybody, just tell the church. The church withdraw their commendation. Sorry, buddy, you go down. It's simple. How do you fire Christians without dividing the church? How do you fire Christians without wrecking the work? Very, very, very difficult. I've never had to fire anyone but one cook. I had to invite him to leave, and that was a problem. But he should never have come. And that was a mistake that we made. He was from another denomination, and his wife was always pushing their denomination, made herself a thorough nuisance. Became a tremendous tension. So that's it. I was talking down here. Committed Christian, commended by their own church, some specific skill. The secret of leadership is always surround yourself with people better than you are. This isn't a boast. We ran a beach mission. I guess it became possibly the greatest in Australasia. I may have mentioned that some other time. It was a fabulous mission. All I did was walk around and look intelligent. We had brilliant musicians and brilliant soloists. Remember one night the power went off and everything was a shambles and we had about 1,500 people on the bank and the power had gone fuck. Somebody had broken the lead. Some idiot was trying to wreck the show. The lights had all gone out and it was chaos. And I knew that our sound guy would be fixing it, so no use me panicking. And I got one of the team leaders, I knew, a beautiful girl. I said, will you just come and sing love? I yelled, I got a good voice. Okay, everybody! You know, and I yelled out, just a minute. I said, okay, darling, sing. So what do I sing? I said, I don't know, but just sing. And she sang, just without any sound, the old rugged cross. And the whole crowd just settled down and settled down and settled down. And she sang it without music and got time to get a guitar. And she sang, you know, her voice just went right across that crowd. And then when I said, darling, do something else. What? Anything, sing. And she just said, and mission was good. Don't get idiots. Camp is not a place for uncommitted, apathetic, backslidden Christians. Don't get them. Don't take pity on somebody that turns up, can't get a job in secular work, so you take them on. Don't do that. You can take them on for a week, you can take them on for a month as a helper, not as a staff member. You're busy enough trying to get kids, teenagers that come to your camp, family groups that come and they've got a moaner in the middle of the pile. You need people that can take pressure, that work 7 days a week, maybe 18 hours a day sometimes, that can work when they're exhausted. Anybody can serve God when they're fit and well and fresh. It takes commitment when you're dead on your feet. And you don't know how you're going to put one foot in front of the other. And you say, dear Lord, you pick them up, I'll put them down. And you're that shot. Now that's what you're after. You want a person that will give you 100% plus. But somebody who won't get up this morning because they didn't get to bed last night till 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock or 1:30 because they were counselling, that is no good to me. I am not interested. And all our staff are up, shower, dress by 7:30. If you were up last night till 1:30, you're still up this morning, buddy, but you'll have a sleep this afternoon. Once you let give in to one staff member lying in bed, everybody else will have an excuse. We're only human beings. You're up, you're dressed, you look shot. So 3:00 this afternoon, whenever you feel tired, go and have a sleep. That's fine, but let's be up and into this. Demand commitment and you get commitment. Aim for low levels and that's what you end up with. So your staff have got to be committed people, and I'm not interested in working with people that aren't committed. All right, they need to be successful in the secular world. It's often said, if you know, get out of work, you hear these people say, isn't God wonderful? He's got me out of all secular work. He's been fighting this job, fighting that job. I've lost all my work. He's released me from secular work to serve the Lord. Codswallop. You should be a success in your own field first before you start serving God. If you're not self-motivating serving the Lord, you will never. If you're not self-motivating in secular work, you certainly aren't going to be in spiritual work. Don't take deadheads on. They're a pain. Okay, a lot of funny stories about one or two deadheads I've inherited. Talk about their denominational affiliation. We are not one-eyed about this, but as far as our senior staff are concerned, they're all members of the assembly. And that's a reason, because we don't want to have them have divided loyalties. Now, that may vary differently in different camps. Depends a lot on the individual. But I've seen a lot of camps divided. This one's a Baptist, that one's a Presbyterian, this one's a Brethren. And they're talking about how good their church is, and the little cracks they crack. Oh, typical Brethren, you see. Now, it sounded funny, but it's like water dripping on a stone. It begins to wear a bit thin. And I'm not so sure it's safe. Now, I've worked with all kinds of people, and that's fine. But if you're doing that, make sure you keep your denominational affiliation in the background somewhere and a clear job description. All right, temporary staff. Need to be a Christian, so somebody's coming to help you for 6 months or whatever. A guy from Australia arrived last week. Poor guy's been in the kitchen because the chef's wife had a baby, and he's busy in there, so he's helping in the kitchen quite a lot. Commended by the church, that's important, and a clear understanding of their expectation and duration of their stay. What's expected of them? So they're only a temporary person. They've come over from Australia, they've come over from New Zealand, they've come from another state to work at your camp for 6 months. They want to know what they've got to do. And how long are they going to stay? Now, I always build in to anybody, even a staff member, when our chef comes, he comes for 2 years, and that's it. So at the end of the 2 years, he finishes. If we don't want him back again, we say, well, you've done your 2 years. Thanks so very, very much. There's a wonderful gift. You've finished. If he wants to stay on, we can invite him, but he doesn't lose face, we don't lose face, and it's easy. We never take anybody on limitless. It's always 2 years. In fact, they come for 6 months on a trial basis to either person, then they stay either for 1 or 2 years, but it's never more than a two-year basis. And I've always worked for myself. My job keeps getting included in a two-year basis. Well, it's a three-year basis because I finished in March 1990. But even for temporary staff, they need to be Christians. Camp leaders and support leaders that come and help you in your children's camp are committed Christians, have attended your camp training courses, respond to leadership. Leaders who won't be led are a problem. And our leadership ratio is 1 to 5, ideally. Cadet leaders are Christian. These are kids 16 and over that help in a cabin. And so there's a leader and a cadet leader. That makes the ratio 1 to 5. You see, cabins take 12 people, so that's 10 kids, 2 leaders. A Christian, evidence of Christ in their life, and they're only 16 years old, they're not going to be the Apostle Paul, must have done an Emmaus course before they come. So if they're coming in May, they've got to have done an Emmaus course. If they come back in August, they've got to do another Emmaus course. They must be doing Emmaus courses. Emmaus is quite a nice organisation, really. There's a place in Sydney they've got 1 or 2 quite nice people there. Alright, and once again, respond to leadership. Training on site, we have special training days, and the Emmaus course, Understanding People, is a fantastic course, and it's compulsory reading for all our staff. It's a brilliant course, it really is. Alright, projection of your teaching. Can you just read your notes on that, because I'm going to run out of time. I've just made the point that we've come through the post-figurative culture, where children took their guidance from their elders. We're now slipping out of what's called the co-figurative culture, where people take their standard of living from their contemporaries. We're in what's called the pre-figurative culture, where people look to children to set the standards. And I've said children are center stage, and everything revolves around children. Music, fashion, behavior, language, sex. Money is, there's more money made out of children than anybody else. And so when you're working in youth work, you've got to understand the pressures. Those last few things are important. uses at home in this bewildering age, this computerized age, the age of the silicon chip. Not this watch, because it's my son's. My other watch was bust, but my other watch was a nice watch. It was a stopwatch and other bits and pieces, but I couldn't get the something to work on it. And a little kid, I said, "Hey, son, can you get my watch going for me? I wanted to find out how to get the stopwatch or something on it." He said, "Yeah, sure. Hang on." And he goes, "Tum, tum, 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 tum." I said, "Hey, what have you done?" Because it wasn't a thing like it was all a digital. And the whole thing was covered in numbers. I said, "What have you done?" He said, "Oh, it's just to show you all the things that your watch does." And I said, "Do that again slowly." He goes, "There it is." No, it was a stopwatch. It was a lot of things that weren't advertised in the leaflet that he got that watch to do. I said, "Well, I wanted to do the stopwatch." He saw you do this, 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 this. And I found out how to do the stopwatch. I went back and read the leaflet. That little kid, you know, when you sit a little 10-year-old down behind a computer, they're away. Sit us down and we're... I played with our computer the other day, turned on the games and couldn't turn it off at lunchtime. And I was trying to find a game and I found the games on the computer and the jolly thing was making a noise. Bing, bong, shh, boom. And I got caught in the camera. I couldn't turn it off. I was pushing all the buttons down off. I got yelled at by the staff, "Get out of my computer." So the thing that I want to say about that when you're thinking of these kids, that's the world they live in. So you've got to communicate in their language and in their thinking. This generation is moving further and faster than any other generation before them. But this is the important thing, the generation not guaranteed a future. We talk about nuclear catastrophe, and this is the only generation that's ever been in this world that is not guaranteed tomorrow. That's why the rule, experience is truth, is the problem. You can't guarantee me tomorrow, so I will experience it now. Mental development, the human race, is gradually becoming homogenized, I enjoyed writing this, into one faceless, monolithic mess. And our job is to drag people out of that mess and to lead them to Christ. I've made the point that we're in the day of the lowest common denominator, and I've briefly described there in the rest of that the world in which we see childcare centres, contraception, the changing rule of women, a high divorce rate, people living defective relationships, the marriage union severed, single parent homes, moral decline, legalized sodomy, homosexuality, lesbianism, and these are what you're fighting. And all our teenage kids, we always have a sex talk. That's pretty basic. I did this at a school yesterday with the senior class. It was pretty basic. I think it took one or two people's hair off their chin. But you've got to talk about what it is. They know where it's at. And we walk along there as if sex, what sex? Is that brown eyes? And we just ignore it. These kids are involved in it. Sex to the average 13-year-old kid in New Zealand is no different than you and I having a cup of coffee. It means no more. They have sex. They don't even know each other's name. And we have to stand against that very strongly and make sure that in our philosophy we're dealing with kids and people where the problem is. We're not dealing with the problem as it was 10 years ago, but problems as they are now. And I've talked about experience truth. I'll just finish these. I'll only be a few minutes, kids. If you want to go, Dash. Physical development, an aspect of Christian camping that's extremely important, must be seen as a spiritual concept. All right? Don't look upon the physical thing as just physical. It's spiritual. Lots of kids you never reach. I remember we used to run canoe camps through the Bay of Islands, and they'd get all these bunch of hoods on the wharf, put them in a canoe, and they'd be exhausted and couldn't paddle. Well, they got a paddle. They couldn't stick their fingers in their jeans and just lean against a dairy wall. They got a paddle. They got a lake, and they got water, and they got waves, and they got a paddle. They got the only way they're going to get was wind. And I've come behind some kids, and I've whacked them across the back of the paddle to make them more scared of me than they are. And they've got there. Remember doing this once to some two boys, and they were in a two-seater, because in the sea we always use two-seaters, in the river single-seaters. And I had to push them and bang them, and eventually I got them there, and they went down. They were big, tough kids. But their muscles go here, because they were silly. They weren't standing up straight. You know, when you paddle with a canoe, your straight arms, keep your back straight. Don't do this sort of thing, because you'll kill yourself. Nice straight arms, so your back doesn't leverage. And these kids were being smart. They wouldn't listen. They didn't take any of the lesson. We can everybody out. They'll know how to can out. We know, teach them how to raft up. Anyway, these idiots did all that, but they wouldn't listen. And they're exhausted. They got to get there. Well, they eventually got there. They pulled their boat up and dropped to the ground. But this is what they said. "We made it." That was the first challenge they'd ever met in their life and won. And from then on, they were different kids. They listened to devotions, playing sport with kids. I went to a camp. It was a disaster. I like soccer. I'm not very good at it, but occasionally an angel helps. And the leaders were hopeless. They were all lounging around and said, "Okay, kids, go down to the beach, look after yourselves." I thought, sick. So I went down with them. We put a couple of jumpers, had some goals, and the goodness of the Lord, I managed to score three. I suddenly found the ball in front of me, kicked it, went in the goal. They virtually carried me off the beach. I was taking devotions. That's why I wanted to know them when I was doing devotions last weekend. And when I was at the elders' conference, their elders, well, they can get on without me. I didn't have breakfast because they don't have breakfast. But when I was trying to win these kids, I came and had breakfast. And I sat down with these people because having breakfast was a spiritual exercise. And by sitting at the table, that's why I wanted to serve that meal. And I said, Saturday night meal, I went into the kitchen and said, can I serve the food? Because it's a communication. And sport's communicative. Sport is spiritual. Your physical program is a spiritual program. So don't sort of put it down. It's an area where leaders communicate. That's pretty obvious. There are lots of dangers. Make sure your equipment's safe. We talked about that last week. Spiritual development, make sure that that's all under control. Planned, consecutive, relevant. It's challenging. Visually presented. We have a law. Every message, either a group discussion or our evening chapel time, must be visualized. So you had your notes 6 weeks ago. There was a visualized ideas in the notes you had. Very simple, very simplistic, because we want you to use your own ideas. If you can't do it, you write to us and we send them to you. Done. But we'd like you to do your own, because if it's your own, it'll color the way you teach. And you must have a visual board. The reason is, not just because you learn more by seeing, that's not the reason really. The reason is that if Brad's got to provide a visual aid, he's got to do the study. But what happens is, we've all been Christians long enough, what are the studies on this time? Oh, we're doing the Gospel of Mark. Oh, I know the Gospel of Mark. You just chuck it in the back of your bedroom until the day of camp, grab your Bible, grab your notes, off you go, you waffle through. But if you've got to do visual aids, you've got to think. See, this message would be far more easy to preach to you if I didn't have to provide acetates and notes. If we didn't have notes, it would be a piece of cake. But once you have to do notes, you see a sequence, and you've got to make sense. You've got to follow through, haven't you? And so we insist on that, and capably taught, we have teaching meetings for that. I'm just about through, folks. And if you want to cover any of these next week, you can certainly do so. Prayer in your camping philosophy. Staff meetings. I've just mentioned those. Keep a prayer list. My wife sends me our staff meetings each week, and they're here if you want to see them. Don't read the back, because there's one of them. She's wrote me a nice little love note in the back. But there's our staff meeting notes, and they just talk about the devotion we have. As I've mentioned there, we have a devotion that usually lasts for half an hour, and there's a brief. When I'm there, I normally write out what they said, but Judy just puts down the passages that were read. We're doing promises of God at the moment for our devotions. Last year we did a book of the Bible, a staff meeting, just quickly through each book of the Bible, a lot of fun, except books like Isaiah, we'd take two. And then the meetings that people have had, a guy called Russell's been at Matter, and Robin was talking on baptism at another church. The weekend group enjoyed themselves, well organised. What was the other weekend group like? That was also pretty good. It was not well organised, sorry. It was the comment on the weekend was not well organised, a very different sort of group. Then it talks about general things. There's a door handle broken here. There's another door handle broken there. Another door handle broken on survey 2. The washing up in the girls' kitchen needs to be kept a lot cleaner. Cabin 3 of block 1, the light fitting is broken, and the dorm keys have gone missing, which is nothing new. We've got a whole lot of them, but the special one's gone missing. Weeks in is Tauranga Primary School. Mr. Gear is the teacher. 64 expected in, plus 66 coming on Wednesday, that puts it up to somewhere around about 120. Friday night's our follow-up meeting in Tauranga at 6 o'clock. Saturday night's our follow-up meeting in Auckland. Sunday night's our follow-up meeting at Totara Springs. It's a barbecue. And then things for prayer and praise and so on. Everybody gets one of those, okay? And you use the prayer and praise for your own quiet time. So your staff meeting is tremendously important. It lasts for an hour and a half. Encourage your individual staff to have their quiet times, and they use the staff minutes as I've suggested. Assembly prayer support, keep them informed, and a bi-monthly newsletter you send out to assemblies and to individual people that want to know. Leaders meetings at camp, if we had a children's camp, we meet at 6 o'clock in the lounge, somebody patrols the cabin to make sure everybody's behaving and not being idiots, and we have tea and coffee up there very, very quickly. You've got to be fed and watered by 6, and then we have a leaders meeting where you teach a lot of things. You talk about counselling and things you're going to do, games you're going to run, and the spirit time, the prayer time, then we go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, all the ones are there, 2's are there, 3's are there, and everybody prays. I'm going to this, I'm not being critical, and I'd hate to be quoted, but I'm going to a missionary thing on Saturday, and a brother told me we want you to give us a nice, what do you say? We would like you to preach to us. We just want a nice little word of encouragement, brother. But prayer meetings can kill people. And so we break up into little prayer and everybody prays. And if you're too scared, you're a cadet leader and you haven't been to camp before and you find you with four other people, you just stand in a circle and he takes over, you just say, thank you, Lord Jesus, when it's your turn. Well, thank you, Lord. And we all know that you've prayed, and that's it. And you get going, so it's no embarrassment. Encourage your campers' prayer times in their study groups to use the chapel, and special prayer times for special needs. Occasionally you have an emergency on. Our prayer is not a question of time, it's a question of values. When you place the right value on prayer, your program will adjust to it. In conclusion, finally, down the last straight, we're talking about communication. That's one of the hard things about camp, communicating to the people. And I've given the illustration, for instance, of the Tower of Babel, but just go down these notes. Communication is sharing verbally and non-verbally so that your message is accepted and understood. And I've said there, you told them, but you didn't communicate. That's a joke in our camp. A person said, Malcolm, look at those people. Look what they're doing. I said, well, you should have told them. I told them, don't say it. Because I'll say, you told them, but you didn't communicate. How often do we tell people, but we don't communicate? Telling people is not communication. You know, a preacher tells people, but he doesn't communicate. So you've got to find a way that you communicate. Now, the success depends on a team project, and that's the Tower of Babel. And there were four things in building the Tower of Babel. One, a commitment to the goal. Let's build. They were committed. Two, unity among the workers. They're all working hard together. Three, there was an effective communication system. They all spoke the same language. They weren't doing the will of God, and of course that's important for us. But when God wanted to mess up the Tower of Babel, he didn't send lightning and thunderbolts and earthquakes. He just wrecked the communication system. Piece of cake. And nearly every organization stands or falls on their ability to communicate to their staff. And somebody feels, nobody told me there was a special this or that or whatever. Why wasn't I told? I said to him, darling, you thought the committee would have told me. He said, well, darling, who are you? He's good for me. But that doesn't excuse them. So communication's important. Your staff meeting, and I've given you an outline of it there, 30 minutes devotion, review of the commitments, controlled general discussion, that's controlled, I chair it, and make sure that we keep moving, proposed numbers coming in, special needs, the host, what they want for the week, or something special they want to do, staff responsibilities for the week, staff commitments for the week, he's preaching here, she's taking a lady's coffee hour, this one's doing a demonstration at this church down the road, let's all pray about it, we finish with prayer and praise, and we don't insist totally, we have a communal morning tea. Everybody stays in our house, in our lounge. We have morning tea together, and it's rather good. But on Friday afternoon, it's compulsory morning tea, and that is that everybody comes for afternoon tea, on a Friday afternoon, and we go to different homes. They know it's on. It's in the staff minutes, and you'll find it down here somewhere. Afternoon tea was Joan on this particular one, and dinner, Lorraine was doing it for the singles, and so it goes on. It's all in the minutes. And so we do these. I write the minutes as we go along. While somebody's talking about something, I'm writing the minutes down, hand them to my wife. She types them out while they're having morning tea, and when they leave, they're ready to go. Or if not, sometimes she gets caught out. When the kids come home from school, they run around and deliver them. See, all their names are at the bottom here, and my wife will just cross off one. So that means that's the person that gets to it. Everybody gets the minutes. No excuse. Everybody was at the meeting. They all had a chance to discuss the problem. They all got the minutes of the decision that was made. And there's a name alongside the person who knew the job to do. So next staff meeting, we get back and say, now, what was the problem here? The door handle wasn't fixed. It was your job, John. Why wasn't it fixed? Your name was down about it. We were pulling some people's leg last night. This brother and I have had a lot of fun together. You know, the way to have an elders meeting to get nothing done is to make a lot of discussions, but don't put anybody's name against the job. The job never gets done. You only put people's names there if you want to get a job done. How many elders have meetings and make great big decisions? Nothing ever gets done because nobody ever puts a name alongside it. It's your job. So make sure that that's important. Walking management. If you're the boss of an area or you're the director, try to walk around. We've talked about this before, so I don't have to stress that. 1 minute management is 1 minute comment to a person. The one-minute manager. Very good book. There's one-minute manager in action. And then working together with people is tremendously important. Just listen to this to give you an idea that everything in our camp isn't perfect. My wife had to talk to some of the staff about a problem. So she wrote this out. She rang me and said, and read it to me over the phone and said, is it okay? And I said, sounds good to me. So she had it all. She printed out. Everybody had a copy as they came in. and then she read it, you could see some of the problems. Because we are living as well as working together, we must not encroach on others' privacy. Obviously, that had been a problem this week. So she had a crack at that. Boys, don't use the girls' flat as your kitchen and lounge, and don't continually go into each other's units. In other words, stay out of each other's houses and units. Okay, the girls have got a nice little flat in the kitchen, and the boys like to sort of camp down there for supper. Well, don't. I presume you're all using the camp washing machine, which of course you knew some of them weren't, or using the girls' washing machine. Don't use the private ones, others before you have managed. In other words, we've been doing this for 16 years. It's worked for 16 years, so it can certainly work for you jerks. If you get stuck and you can't get the washing machine, come and give your washing to me, says Judy. And she'll sort them out. If you get over familiar and things get tense, it's very difficult to work together. Don't hassle each other. The person may be tired and you may offend them. Many things said in jest can hurt. So something had happened there that she'd had a funk at. For the one-year people, we have students for 1 year. For one-year people, it's a year of discipline. Maybe doing things you don't wish to do. But if you can't stick out a year here, then you won't be much good for God in the future. That's pretty blunt. But it's true. If you can't do as you're told here for a year under the discipline of the organisation of this camp, then son, you're not going to be any use anyway. You're just going to be one of these individualists pain in the necks. And no one's any right but you. Even God's wrong. And that's what she's saying there. People have got to learn discipline. And that's what they're there for. So she had a crack at that. Please. If you don't agree with something, see me and I'll try to sort it out or bring it up at the staff meeting. That's the rule. Please do the work you're asked to do willingly, on time and happily. Some of you don't like picking blackberries. Okay. But it's only a short-term thing and it'll be over in a couple of weeks. Often we're asked to do an extra job. Surely we can accommodate these. In brackets. If you think you're too busy, then work out a timesheet. Sit down and find out what you're doing with your time, because everybody else has done it. You're fluffing around. If you have a job and it's impossible to do because it's your weekend off, and that should be the only reason, she says in brackets, then see Stan as the manager or myself, or arrange with someone else. Don't just expect someone else to fill in. If you form a clique, and some of these singles have formed a little clique, if you form a clique and have a moan together, you'll create a barrier that will harm the staff relations and the whole staff. Please don't run down camp or complain outside these gates. We're a family, and families may have problems within, and then in capitals, but never let on to others. She's talking about staff loyalty. Now, I love my wife. That took a lot of doing for a lady to put that together with a staff of 16 and sit down the staff being read out. But it's good, and I couldn't have put it together any better, and that's where we stand. And if you don't like it, she would say, then you know what to do. Because we only want committed people. Things aren't rosy. You have problems. You've got to learn to deal with them. Finish. Purity of living. Work it out. What your moral standards are for sex. Immorality. Are you going to have cultism? Social groups? Community groups? Clubs? Rotary lives? What's your decision about those? Do you have them, don't you? Extreme Pentecostal groups. I tried to be Pentecostal. I tried to believe the Pentecostal thing was the real deal. I do not believe in Pentecostalism, and I believe it is one of the most divisive things that's ever come around. I'm being blunt and straight. It's the first time I've said it in the whole month I've been here. But that's where I stand. Behavior, sexual relationships. What's your philosophy about that? Alcohol, dancing, smoking, language, standards of dress in the pool. We have a rule in the pool. Girls may wear bikinis. The first bikini that comes off, every girl will wear a t-shirt. That's the rule, and it's simply it. You may wear bikinis, sure. Girls are funny. They wear the briefs of the bikini they can find. They put on the cabin, and they wrap a towel around them so nobody can see. And they get to the edge of the pool, and they drop a glove and plop in. But then there are the little girls that are proper little bitches, and they've got a bikini, and when they get in, they just undo the bra and drop it off and say somebody pulled it off. So a bikini comes off, every girl, whether it's a full costume or not, wears a t-shirt. Simple rule. And it's happened more than once. And then what are you going to do in the dining room? I refuse to serve anybody in our dining room with a singlet on. Certainly I won't serve anybody, don't care who they are, man or woman, family camp, with a bare shirt. All right? But I don't like it. Dinner, lunch, I don't worry too much. But dinner at night, we've got lovely tablecloths and flowers on the table, and some guy comes in with a singlet, he's insulting my cook. Sometimes we put the slides up and we go table at a time and we don't have long queues. You know, like you were doing at your camp, Felder. And if people rush up, I say, okay, go, slides across. Put slides across and go, excuse me, everybody, but our chef here is a professional chef. He's provided a beautiful meal, and you're not going to behave in this dining room like that. I'm sorry. but you will all please sit down and come up to the servery orderly and sensibly and properly. Busted. I've got a, this chef here is giving me his heart. And once he knows that I stick up for him like that, he'll give me his heart. But if I let my staff be trampled on by idiots, and I don't stick up for my staff, then they're not going to love me and they're not going to support me. If their staff, I've got to know, as far as you're concerned, your staff come first. Nobody would dare throw water in our dining room. Let somebody try. And boy, oh boy, would there be a row. It's happened, obviously. And Brother Barrow gets in the middle of it, and there is a fairly lengthy discussion, a bit one-sided. Summary. The philosophy of camp needs to be prayerfully thought out and carefully worded. Trustees, camp committee and staff must be aware of the camp's philosophy and support it with conviction. The camp philosophy should be reconsidered at least annually. The philosophy or the plan of camp that you had so many years ago may not be adequate today. Don't be afraid to change. All right, so there we are. Sorry I've gone way over time, and Andrew really has every right to tell me off, because he did tell me about the studies, and I don't know, they've just gone too long. We talked too much. We've one session left next week. I'll just leave these staff minutes here. If you want to see them, you're very welcome. They're very simple, but they just everywhere. And everybody has a manila folder with a little clicker in it. They should be punched. And they just punch them and put them in, and everybody brings their staff minutes to the staff meeting. And about every 3 months, I get some junior staff member and say, hey, your job is to go through the staff minutes for the last 3 months and find out all the things that we're supposed to have done that we haven't done. And it's funny, because it's a great long list of jobs we all decided to do and we forgot. No, they just get lost. So it brings them all up to the surface, sit there for a whole afternoon, and brings us all back to square one again.